Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to embark on a journey like no other. Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast,
your go-to destination for a unique blend of recovery and discovery.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. And in this podcast, we will endeavor to create a safe and uplifting space for our guests and listeners to share their stories with sincerity and a touch of humor.
Remember, we are not a glum lot. The Glum Lot Podcast is more than just a source of entertainment. It's a beacon of hope, proving that even in the darkest moments, recovery is possible. Every story we share carries the power to inspire positive change.
So buckle up, get ready to listen, and join us in discovering the strength that lies within every individual's journey. This is the Glum Lot Podcast, where humor meets hope. All right, B-Rett, we are on episode number 23 of the Glum Lot Podcast.
Oh,
I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad you're here.
Oh, look at us. We're so glad we're here. And I also wanted to reiterate that we are heard around the globe. And we also wanted to ask listeners from around the globe to please send us an email from your, tell us what home country you're from.
Yeah.
And how you received the podcast in order.
How have you received
not
us?
On what platform, but how did you like it, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
At theglumlotpodcast@gmail.com. And with that being said, what is your topic of discussion for this evening? Or,
well,
this morning or this afternoon, wherever people are listening to this.
Ooh, very, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
when.
I didn't
midnight.
Think of that.
Could
yeah.
be midnight. We don't know.
Could be. 5
what do you
o'clock
got?
Somewhere.
What do you got?
Wait. So, I'm tired today.
Yeah.
And
you're tired of me or just tired?
In general. And I am definitely having a hard time with any kind of motivation. I'm just tired, and I don't know sometimes how to get out of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, can be triggers
mm-hmm.
for us as alcoholics to seek relief. And we have to learn how to cope with those types of feelings. And I, you know, when I'm tired, I tend to half-ass everything, including my thinking.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we talk on the podcast a lot about a case of the fuckets.
Oh, yeah.
And that can be,
in
tired
buckets.
Can be one of the thing, you know, that create that.
Any one of those hungry.
Yeah, if you don't take care of yourself. This, you know, the self-care aspect of sobriety is huge. We haven't really done much of it. We've always had care of our disease
mm-hmm.
to keep it safe. But self-care in a healthy way is of prime importance. And for a lot of us, it may be the first time we've done it, and we have to learn to do it. It doesn't come naturally to us. So getting enough sleep, knowing when to go to bed and setting an alarm and getting up. I'm huge on the nap. I know sometimes things get really busy, and we don't have that opportunity.
Yeah, but a nap means I have to stop thinking for a few seconds.
Thank God.
Well, I don't know.
You know, and that's where meditation comes in.
This is true, and you're an expert on that.
No, I don't know if I'm an expert, but I can do it. I can slow my mind down. And if you don't know how, please seek that out. Vipassana meditation is a very good, you know, being in the current moment.
And what is it called?
Vipassana with a V. Vipassana.
A Vipassana.
Well, it's not Italian.
Not that kind.
A Vipassana. No, I believe it's
Vipassana.
Vipassana might be Sanskrit or, you know, I'm making this shit up at this point.
Yeah.
But,
well, I'm so tired. I'm getting whippy.
Yeah. You're believing it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, learning how to quiet your mind can be a great asset, and not only for taking a nap, but for calming yourself down in situations where it's a high anxiety.
Well, to be honest with you, I think that's why I'm so tired.
Oh, from the anxiety?
Yep.
Man, that'll wear you out, won't it?
It does.
It will.
It does, but, you know, I also know that I got to tell somebody about it. And,
right,
you know,
talking about it's a great.
Solves half the problem.
It does.
Because now I've learned about Vipassana. Oh, Vipassana.
Vipassana.
Okay, Vipassana.
Yes. But any kind of, you know, there's a million kinds of meditation, different names, but they're all basically the same thing. And that's quieting your mind.
Yeah.
Stopping what the Indians called the monkey mind.
Yeah, and I know how I used to quiet my mind.
Yeah.
But that's just not going to work.
No. And you know what? It's not as effective.
No.
Once you learn how to meditate, it's much more effective.
Yeah, you come out refreshed instead of puking.
Right. And, you know, we talk about cultivating serenity in sobriety. Boy, that's a great way to practice serenity.
Boy, yeah.
You know, we talk about in the 11th step, prayer and meditation. And people have said, to me. Prayer is us talking to a higher power. Meditation is us listening. And that's true for me.
Oh,
It doesn't always mean listening to words. Sometimes this is like listening to the feeling of your own body and your environment, you know, and you can feel the presence of a spirit when you're in that meditation. It is very refreshing.
And see, you know? This is why I come to you.
But
I mean, as a newer person, I've only got 2.5 years, right? And we come to you guys for this type of stuff because where else are we going to learn it?
Yeah. And, you know, I learned it over the course of years.
Right.
And I took meditation courses from people and I read a lot and I tried stuff. I went to the Zen Center for a spell and learned Zen meditation. And all these things are really helpful. And when you are on the road of sobriety, they're important things to seek out. You know, I think by nature, too, we talked about alcoholics being bright. We're seekers.
We are.
We seek. And if you seek, ye shall find. Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. So, but anyways, but I digress. I like when people say that, but I digress.
Well, it's okay. It's okay because, you know, you taught something to me and hopefully everybody out there will have an interest in maybe finding out a little bit about meditation because it does work. And I think that would have prevented me from getting to where I'm at right now. So thank you, Mark.
I can help. Well, you know, the pleasure, sir, is mine. We have a guest today.
We do.
Yeah. And this guy he's a cool guy.
I'll say, yeah.
He is a cool guy with a cool story. A great message. And this guy is like has a very gentle way.
He is. Yeah. It seems like he's got some serenity for sure.
And a great sense of humor.
And he's very wise.
Yes. Let's bring him on. Ed.
Ed.
Ed, welcome to the Glumlot Podcast. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And can we start with your sobriety date?
My sobriety date is 7/24/04.
Okay. So you've been around a few years.
Hoping for 20 years this summer.
A few 24 hours,
awesome,
as they like to say. So let's start, as we always try to, with the beginning. Do you remember your first drink or drinks, your first buzz, your first experience?
First feeling.
Oh, yes. I come from a Polish immigrant family, and as a child, I was the bartender.
Oh.
I would run for the beers and the drinks when my dad and his friends were hanging out. So
Eddie, grab me a cold one.
Yes. So I would always either get to start one or finish one, depending on what I wanted to do.
How old were you at this point?
Oh, this could have been 6, 7, 8, 9.
So sometimes you'd crack one, take a swig, and then deliver
or
it?
Or finish at the end. It was always curious, like, why are they all drinking this? So
yeah.
And they're having fun.
Do you remember catching a buzz as a kid, or was it not a factor?
I don't know if I caught a buzz, but I it didn't hurt me when I did it. So
yeah, sure.
I thought, like, this isn't bad. My parents are having fun doing this. I want to be like that.
There it is.
Okay.
Then eventually that kind of took over into, yeah, I like this. You know, I like the feeling I have when I have just a little bit.
Okay. Did there come a point in which you liked the feeling you had when you had a lot of bit?
Well... Yeah, I mean, like I said, I grew up in an area where there was there was 5 bars in a 2-block area.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said, it was the Irish neighborhood and the Polish neighborhood, and all the dads walked to the bars at night. So I remember constantly watching them either drink or drinking in the park at any age, or Boone's Farm.
Yum, yum.
When we weren't old enough and the older people would get it for us.
Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill.
Yes.
So it was almost a cultural thing, right?
It's definitely a cultural thing.
Right.
I mean, my dad's friends didn't drink beer. It was a quart of whiskey, a pitcher of water, and a glass.
Mm-hmm.
You poured the whiskey, you poured the water.
Chase it.
And then the next guy. There wasn't really a whole lot of beer around. The beer came for us.
Mm.
Because I had a friend whose mom worked at a Big M.
Big M grocery store.
Yes. So she was helping cashier. So she would sometimes put cases out the back. and we would meet up before school, 7th, 8th grade, down the park, and drink before we went to school. So this has been a part of my life. I don't remember it not being a part of my life.
Right, right, yeah, right.
And I always remember that when I did it, I was part of the crew.
Yeah.
Right. There's that social aspect.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah.
I definitely fit in better after a couple of drinks than before a couple of drinks.
You know, when we talk about this with a lot of our guests, that when you're young, part of it's the buzz, part of it is the feeling of getting away with something, and part of it is fitting in.
And being grown up.
And being in a crew, you know, being socially accepted. So as you got into your teen and later teen years, did your drinking progress?
Oh, yes. Like 7th, 8th grade, I also found pot.
Okay.
So yep. That kind of helped with the drinking. But at my age, when I was 14, you could get into a bar and drink because there was no picture licenses.
Right,
and
the drinking age was 18.
Yeah.
And you guys had it so good.
The licenses were just papers with descriptions on
them.
Yeah,
you and I are probably about the same age.
Yeah, so I'm in my early 60s. So
yeah, me too. Yep.
I was able at 14 to go to this local bar for 10 Cent Tuesdays.
Nice.
Which was 10 cent Pabst drafts.
I remember 10 cent draft night where I live too.
Right. So for $2, yeah. I could have 10 beers and play 4 games of foosball. And the place was so packed that they didn't check IDs.
Right. Nobody gave a shit.
I had a little skinny mustache.
Yeah.
And that was close enough.
Yeah,
so.
I did the same thing at our local bar. It was Monday night, 10 cent draft night. Monday night at the fights, we used to call it, because it would always be fights.
Yes.
And the cops would come. And us underage kids, I was 15. We would all have to go out the back door. And as long as we did that, the bar owner did not care. And right, you go up with a dollar and you'd come back with 10, your fingers and 10 plastic cups for all your crew that you're with and you're shooting pool or doing whatever you're doing. And the next guy would pony up the dollar for the next ones. Right.
For us, it was foosball. There was a foosball table there.
Yep.
And that's what we would do, like say. And it was so packed that, plus the owners of the bar were firemen. So unless there was something really bad that happened, the police just never came.
Yeah.
So it was, that was my experience. That was the time I started sneaking out at night.
Mm-hmm.
Started after a while, when I was 16 and got my license, taking my mom's car and after they went to bed so I could drive to the
bar
instead.
Did you guys used to roll it down the driveway in neutral and not start it? That's what we did. We would put it in neutral and push it, roll it down the driveway so it wouldn't... Because my dad would park it next to the house, and it was in between two houses, and you'd hear it, like, reverberating. Yeah. So we'd push it down to the road, then start it, and then go.
Usually my dad wouldn't wake up, because he was drunk, so.
he would, it was
my,
good.
But
it
my mom, yes, could have. And my mom never really confronted me about it, let's say.
Yeah.
So there was nights where I would wait until they went to bed. At 16, I would go out, grab the car, and go to the bar, and stay until 1:32 and drive home. And this was a normal thing for me and my friends.
Did you worry about getting caught?
No.
No.
There was no reason to worry. I mean, I was 5 or 6 blocks from home. The worst thing that would have happened, more than likely, was the local cop who we knew.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, it was usually
very
the
localized.
Same policeman that would show up at the park and he knew all your faces. More than likely, he would have followed me home. And probably after a few times, he would have gotten in trouble. But I remember many times where it was like, they'd either take your keys and look for the soberest one in the car, or they'd throw them into the park, so it took you an hour to find them.
Yes, yeah.
And then that would sober you up, or how far away are you from home?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I got a DWAI once at 28 years old, so it wasn't legal consequences that got me here.
Yeah, and so during this time, as you're a teen, are you exposed to drugs?
Yes. I'll date myself, but it was the late 70s.
Yeah.
So everything was available.
Right.
This was before crack. So it was not, the environment was not one of fear or.
Right. And the war on drugs had not really started yet.
No. We had the Rockefeller laws or whatever back then.
But no Nancy.
No. But like I said, at that point, drugs was more of a let's get together thing than it was a. I'm going to take my drugs and go home in the house by myself and then come steal
more
yours.
More of a social.
Yes.
So you're smoking weed.
Smoking weed, Quaaludes, cocaine, normal stuff for the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. And that's all available.
Yes.
And so are you getting in trouble with that?
No.
At that point? Or are you just like a casual party user?
There were no legal consequences because I wasn't getting in that kind of trouble, but you know, grades were starting to slip off.
Yep.
Jobs were so easy to come by that I would start a job, and if it interfered with a party on the weekend, I would quit that job and just get another job.
Mm-hmm.
So there was consequences I didn't see yet.
Right.
But yeah, they were, now that I look back on it, I can see that my focus on other things was starting to shift over to the lifestyle that I was thought was good for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you graduate high school?
Yes.
Okay, so you graduate high school. What's next for you?
Well, by the time I was 21, we were a family of four. So I, I call her my wife, but we never got married. We were together 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was me, Patty. She had a son already that, like, we grew up together, so we all knew each other. So, but like I said, my daughter was born in 82. I turned 21 that year.
Mm-hmm.
Josh was already 3 and a half. So we were like this little mini family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
So you had to go out and work.
Yes. It was all work. Patty worked. I worked. We did other things to make money that other people in my neighborhood did.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of cash floating around.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I kept a job every day because I grew up in a family where it doesn't matter how drunk you are, you get up and go to work.
Right. You're not going to miss work.
That means you're not an alcoholic.
Right. Because
you're supporting your family.
That's funny because my father was a maintenance drinker. He never missed a day of work. Always got up. He got drunk to pass out every night, got up right in the morning, smoked a cigarette, shaved, got his shit together, went to work. I mean, they'd be drinking by noon at work.
Oh, yeah.
The two martini lunch.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's the old school Elkie.
Yeah.
Right, and as long as you went to work.
Brought home a check.
Yeah, you were good to go. Then
yes.
You deserve to be able to relax.
Yes.
He kind of missed my entire life, but other than that.
Exactly. I think part of it was like, since I come from an immigrant family,
mm-hmm.
By the time I was in third grade, I was reading all the bills. I was.
Did your parents speak English?
They didn't catch it like I did. No.
Yeah.
My dad never really cared. He learned work English.
Right.
Enough to get past his job, and that's about it. You know, maybe watch a little TV. But my mom, she learned more. But like I say, by the time I was in third grade, I knew enough to read the bills, to do this, so I was the interpreter. I was
sure.
Like any other immigrant family that comes here. The oldest child is basically the adult in the family.
Right, right. When you have to deal with the outside world.
Right, because you're the point of contact.
Was that pressure on you? Did you feel that? Or were you even aware?
At first it was like, it was power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like,
English.
And then it became animosity between me and my dad.
Mm.
Because my dad grew up in Poland in World War II. He was born in 1932, so he had to quit school in third grade when the Germans invaded and work on the farm. His older brothers took off, had to go to war. So he used to always call me the professor because I was so smart, he thought. But there was always this difference between us because I was taking what I think he thought was his job.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, because
okay.
I knew things I shouldn't know at 9 years old. Like, are we behind on our bills?
Right.
Who's calling? Like I said, I think it's common in all immigrant families like that.
Sure.
But in my point, I knew things that, and then eventually I just outpaced him and I could read more than him. And all he did was go to work.
Yeah.
I mean, I never.
Right. So he had there was a certain sense of powerlessness.
Yes.
In dealing with the outside world that you took on. So you have this small family, and you're still drinking. You're still in that lifestyle, right? But you're keeping a job because you have to.
Yes.
Does your disease progress?
Yes. I, through my 20s and 30s, it was a nonstop, as we like to say, functional mm-hmm. addict or functional alcoholic life.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely every weekend. But then it got to be, well, we'll add Thursday to it, or then we'll extend it to Monday.
Start a little early, end a little
yes.
late.
Yeah. And Patty the same way. So, like, we tried really hard to be a normal
family.
Couple and a normal family, but most of the families we were with, because at 26, I bought a house up in the university area.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the people we dealt with then were either teachers at the school or doctors. So we were 10 years younger than most of the other families in the neighborhood. And we were closet drug addicts and drinkers,
yes. Yeah.
So we really didn't fit into that neighborhood. Our kids went to school with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't keep up financially. So I it's a struggle now to look back and think, like, our kids had enough, but they never had
Yeah.
What the other kids had.
Right. It wasn't like you're going to get a brand new car at 16.
Right. Yeah.
Where other couples could do that maybe. So there was always tension in the family because either I would break a promise or Patty would break a promise or both of us would break a promise mm-hmm. or somehow we'd spend money we shouldn't have mm-hmm. for an extra night out. Then the kids would have to have something for lunch that they should have had better.
Mm-hmm. So you're sacrificing some of that stuff because of your drug and alcohol use, and that's kind of part of the lifestyle that you're leading, right?
Yes.
And are there consequences beyond that? Any legal consequences that creep in? Not until you're 28, right?
Right, not until I'm 20. I had one DWAI, and that's because I passed out. I threw a rod in a car. I was driving down the highway, and I threw a rod in my car. So I had to pull over, the engine seized, and I just passed
out. Now, by throwing a rod, he doesn't mean that he actually took a rod and threw it through his car. For those out there in podcast land, it's a tie rod, right?
Yeah.
And it blows out of the car and goes through.
Goes through the top of the motor, so all your oil leaks out, so your engine like, seizes.
It's catastrophic.
Yes.
Catastrophic, right. I like that word.
Yes.
Yeah.
The motor seizes up and you cannot drive.
You're done.
So I pull over to the side of the highway and I can't move. Because I'm drunk, so I pass out in the car.
Uh-oh.
I get woken up by troopers, and because I was still in the driver's seat and the keys in the ignition, my excuse that, well, the car won't drive, so how can I get a DWI, doesn't work, because the intent was there, they said. So that was my only legal consequence from this.
That was a bad day. Your car shits
bed. Luck.
And you get arrested.
Yes.
Jeez.
And actually, it was a good day before then because I had gone out to my boss's house for my review, and I'd gotten a raise.
Oh boy, well, you needed it at that point.
But they were drinkers. They were drinkers like I was. So by the end of the night, we were fighting anyways.
Oh God.
And I decided to drive home 40 miles.
That whole dysfunctional lifestyle. Yes. When you look back on it, you're like, what the hell?
Right. I went there. They were happy with my performance at work. I got the raise I wanted at work. Yet somehow, because we were doing shots all night. There was a fight.
Yeah.
And we got in an argument, and they said, you shouldn't leave. And I said, screw you guys. And ended up costing me a couple $1,000.
Bang, boom. So do you go to court for this? Or does your lawyer just kind of take care of
my business? Lawyer takes care of it.
So you don't have to go for the evaluation on that
No, stuff. This was, I was 28, so
yeah,
this was about 19.
Yeah, a long time. Things were different.
Yes, it would have been like 1987, maybe, 88. There was DWI laws I don't think were...
Right, not as stringent.
As big a deal. Since it was my first and basically only arrest ever.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, and that's not a wake-up call for you. You're just like, yeah, it's just bad luck.
That's bad luck.
That's bad luck.
Yes.
So what happens after that?
After that, we're cruising along again. And like I say, what I didn't understand about the lifestyle we were living was that I always thought life was hard for everybody because I was spending every free penny and more on drugs and alcohol so that I could barely pay the bills and take care of the kids. I didn't realize that if I didn't spend all that money over here,
just fine.
I would have had enough.
You thought everybody was living like that.
Yes. I thought everybody's car broke down every once in a while. I thought everybody was late on a mortgage payment. I thought everybody had these issues.
Yeah. When you're involved in that lifestyle and you're hanging out with people that use and drink like you do, you're right. That's it. That is the reality. You know?
Right.
So are there further consequences down the line for you?
For me personally, other than Patty and I, our relationship starting to dissolve.
Okay.
Because as the kids got older, we weren't needed as much at home together.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like I said, by the time I was 39, my youngest was already 18 and graduated.
Yeah.
Patty was 2 years older than me. She was 41. Our oldest child had already moved to Arizona. He was 22 by then.
Okay.
So we were basically empty nesters at 39 years old.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you had each other.
Right. We had each other.
You had each other, booze and drugs.
Yeah.
And we had different lifestyle choices at that point.
Okay.
The drugs and stuff I like to use kept me home.
Oh, okay.
I was more of a...
Downers.
I'm going to eat some pain pills and smoke some pot. And have a few beers and watch something funny on TV. She was more of a,
I'm going out.
We're going to go snort some cocaine and we're going to go head out to the bar and start drinking. And in her mind, it made sense because we'd put in our 20 years of raising our family.
Yeah.
So now it was our time.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, we start going our separate ways.
And so does the relationship fall apart at this
yes.
point? Okay.
By the time we broke up, I was 40. We had split up. So it was like the year 2000, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not dated since 1980.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
You've been out of the game.
Right.
Yeah.
I've been so like, there's AIDS and there's this and there's that and there's all this stuff. And I'm 40 years old and I'm like fresh.
And so are you living alone at this point?
Yeah, my daughter had a boyfriend that they were living together.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a 4-bedroom house.
Mm.
Working still, but drinking every day, doing my drugs. So I find myself getting out of work at 3:30, not wanting to go home because there's nobody there.
Right.
So I find myself going to the bar every day to have a drink
mm-hmm.
because that'll kill a couple hours.
Did your split up bother you?
Oh, yeah. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me.
Mm.
I thought we were going to...
Grow old together.
Right. Watch our grandkids.
So it was a painful time in your life,
Oh, my God,
right?
Yeah. I mean, this was the love of my life at that point. Yeah. I'd known her since I was 14 years old.
Did you fall deeper into the drugs and alcohol at that point?
For a couple years.
To numb the pain?
Yeah, from that... So from 2000 to 2004 is when my bottom really started coming.
Okay.
Because I was by myself.
Yeah.
My kids didn't need me. I had no purpose anymore.
Right. Yeah, sure.
My purpose was just me now. There was no,
yeah.
I got to get home because the kids need something. So I'm directionless now. So all of a sudden, like I said, I'm hitting the bar every day after work. I'm starting to hang out with people that I don't really know because most of the people that were with me that I grew up with are still in their relationships.
Sure.
So I lose my whole social network.
Because is that a lonely time in your life?
Oh, God, yes. I was...
Just looking for companionship, probably.
Yeah, I was kind of lost because everybody I grew up with, we all hung out together. We all had kids together.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, when Patty and I split up, she was the one that made all the plans.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I had no more plans.
Right, she was the social person.
Right, so all the girls still made plans with her.
Sure.
I just wasn't part of that anymore.
Yeah
that really sucks.
Yes, so
it
does. I'm looking at my life.
It's a shitty spot to be in.
And my life is over there without me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still going on, and people are still going camping, and they're still going to concerts, and they're still doing dinner things, and I'm just not part of that.
Did your alcohol and drug use increase?
Yes.
Time spent alone increased?
Yes.
Yeah, that, and so your life starts to get kind of dark, right?
Yes. This is the point where, like I said, I'm 40 years old. Let's just say I'm in my early 40s. I'm looking around, and I'm wondering what the hell happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's this guy that at 25 was managing people 20 years older than him and supposed to be running companies at some point.
Did the thought ever occur to you, maybe my problem is drugs and alcohol, or maybe that's part of my problem?
The thought occurred to me that maybe I shouldn't do as much.
Okay. But not quit.
Right.
Maybe I'm just doing too much.
Yes.
Okay.
So the modifications started coming. Like,
yeah.
Okay, I really don't. I'm not going to start drinking at 3. I'll wait till 7.
I love this.
This kind of...
Yeah. Deal making, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll figure this out.
Right.
I can manage it.
Or, like I said, I won't drink on Tuesday. Or I won't... Or whatever it is. And, 9/11 hits. And the field I was in kind of stopped for a little while. So I ended up getting a job at a local insurance company. So now instead of managing 100 people, I'm sitting...
Hmm.
In a chair with headphones on, listening to people complain about their health insurance.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
And I don't have the freedom to get up and move whenever I want.
Yeah.
Which is killing me. I have to like raise my hand to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because somebody's got to get on the phone.
So this is creating even more anxiety in your life?
Yes. And that also, since that field was mostly women,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a single guy, all of a sudden, there's a whole lot of people with a whole lot of pain pills saying, Ed, I got some extra.
Oh.
So now I start, which I never did, doing drugs at work.
Okay. Like Oxys or?
More like hydrocodones. And
okay.
This was before Oxy. Oxy hadn't come out
gotcha.
Yet.
Okay, gotcha, yeah.
But I never liked those. Thank God for that. But these are like hydrocodones and the mother's little helpers kind of things.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So usually I would never, for my whole career, I never did at work. Always as soon as I got home.
Okay.
But now I start, I should take them an hour before I leave work. So then by the time I'm done.
You're good to go.
Yes. And then all of a sudden, I may as well go to noon. And then I realize I'm physically addicted to these pills.
Mm.
And if I don't have them, I'm in trouble now.
Yeah.
So now life changes.
Yeah. So tell us about that.
That's where the darkness really comes in, because now I'm no longer in charge of my life.
Right.
Yeah. I'm chasing these pills, and whatever it takes for me to have them.
And you're not prescribed them.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
I tried, but there was enough people around that were, where I could have as many as I wanted, but how much money did I have?
Mm.
You know, these things are not cheap.
Right.
And once you start eating them, you need a whole lot more than when you started. So if it was $10 a day, it turns into $50 a day pretty quick or more. And I'm by myself. I got nowhere to go at home. So I'm not going home to anybody. I'm not actively seeking to date anybody unless they have some drugs or alcohol that they can help me out with.
So you're entering a very dark part of your life.
Yes. I'm heading towards my bottom.
Yeah.
Yes. My son, he's, by this time, they've moved from Arizona. He's in Hawaii. So him and three of his buddies took off and did life the right way. They were 19 and left, you know.
Yeah.
But another thing gone.
So my daughter is getting worried about me, because all of a sudden, the person she relies on is, like, not very reliable anymore.
Mm.
And even though she doesn't live at home, I'm not a phone call away anymore. Or she'll come over and I'm in a state that scares her.
Sure.
You know, I'm like out of it because I'm not leaving the house, so I'm mumbling or I'm stumbling. And I'm sure she's used to seeing me inebriated, but never to the point where I can't get up.
You can't function.
Right. Or I need help.
So you've got this drug addiction. You're still alcohol. It's still an issue.
Oh, alcohol was always
there for you.
As soon as you, if you don't drink alcohol with the pills, then you don't.
You'll get the full effect.
Right.
So you're in this really shitty spot. What happens? How long do you stay there?
I realize, 43 is when I got sober.
Okay.
So it's a period of roughly 3 years mm-hmm. that I'm sinking. I'm realizing that at some point I'm going to lose this house because I need more money to stay high and to stay drunk than I have
mm-hmm.
with my bills, because now it's just me paying.
Sure.
And I'm looking around and I got this 4-bedroom house thinking, I don't need this. I could get away with something smaller.
Sure.
So all of a sudden I start thinking I'm going to sell this house. But over the last 4 years, I've done nothing to fix this house because I'm busy, you know?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you know, I get a realtor and I say, oh, you got to do this, you got to do this.
Wait,
and
what?
I'm like, I don't have $15,000 to get this thing ready to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a bind. What do I do, you know?
You're backed into a corner.
Yes. And I could either stay in this house until they take it from me, or until I sell it for a loss, whatever, or I could do something. So what I actually did is I ended up fixing the house. I had help from my parents and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved into an apartment that my mom and dad had. They had a house that we used to live in. So I'm living in this apartment down in the ghetto.
Mm.
It wasn't a ghetto when we lived there, but now it's a ghetto. And I'm living there by myself, and I'm looking around, and I'm thinking,
what has my life become?
Right, exactly. How did I work 20-something years to get here?
Yeah.
Right.
And I have nothing. And I have no prospects, and I have no ambition, and I have no respect for myself. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? I mean, if I do this for any more length of time, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to turn into a person that would rather wish he was dead.
Yeah.
Either way, you know, because there's a lot, you don't see many old addicts.
No.
This is true.
No.
You know, there's not a whole lot of old addicts around, or alcoholics even nowadays. If they're really alcoholics, they don't make it that.
Mm-mm.
You know, and I don't want to turn into this person that has to go on whatever disability to live,
mm-hmm.
Because I know it's not going to pay me enough to keep that lifestyle
keep you going.
Going.
Yeah,
right.
So what? Did something happen?
Well,
is there a moment?
I'm in my apartment,
mm-hmm.
and I'm running out of cash. I'm passing out and waking up. I get to this point where I can't even go an hour without having to take some pills and have a beer. Because I tell myself, I got enough to last me 4 days if I do this.
Right.
But of course, 2 hours later, that plant is gone. And I'm living on my couch. I'm sleeping there. I'm eating there.
Avoiding any kind of reality.
Oh, yeah, that was my reality. The only time I left the house was to either get more beer, get drugs, or if I really had to do something. So I tell myself I got to do something. I find myself, I'm having these pains in my body, mm-hmm. not from the drugs, but from the aspirin that's in the drugs.
Oh.
You can't eat 30 pain pills without taking 30
yeah.
things of aspirin, too. So my kidneys and my liver are starting to hurt. I mean, like, hurt on a daily basis because you can't eat 30 pills. What's right. it, 6 aspirin a day now is going to kill you or something? So I'm eating 30 a day.
Damn.
And I'm feeling this pain, and I'm not getting, it's not like I'm getting a buzz anymore. I kind of had one of these come to Jesus moments, I guess, where mm-hmm. I said, I got to do something.
Right.
So I get on the phone, and I call my doctor. This is the doctor that birthed our kids.
Mm.
When we lived up by the university, he lived up there too, so our kids went to school together.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I've known this guy for 30 years now. We don't hang in the same circles,
yep.
but we're friends yeah. through school. Our kids have spent the night at each other's houses, that kind of thing. And I got to tell him that I need to go to rehab.
Oof.
And he doesn't understand.
Right. He's like, "What do you mean?"
Right, because it's 2004, so it's a little different. And I'm like, I'm addicted to painkillers. I drink every day. I can't function without something in my body. I need to go to a rehab, and I need to go away for 30 days. I need something. And he kind of says, "Let me call you back in an hour." He says, "I can get you into the local rehab Monday." And this is like Thursday. And I'm thinking to myself,
I may not last that long.
Right. So I'm thinking to myself, my thought process there is, what do I do? Do I jam in as much as I can between now and Monday because I know I'm quitting?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I try to help myself? So I try to detox myself.
Oh, boy.
So I live on freeze pops from Thursday till Monday.
Mm.
And I'm throwing up and I'm...
Yeah, you're feeling bad.
Oh, I'm jonesing like... I'm going through withdrawals.
Yeah.
Oy.
But this was the choice I made.
And you're alone?
Yes.
Oh, geez.
So who was I going to tell that I was that bad?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a point in my life where I'm not telling anybody.
Sure.
That, dude, I need help.
So are you just telling yourself, just make it till Monday? Just make it till Monday.
I'm telling myself, I don't know what to do. I got to make it till Monday. Once I get into rehab, I can get 30 days. I can get a couple of weeks off, whatever, where I don't have to worry about anything. They'll take care of me. And then I can figure out whether I can still get high or not, whether I can still drink or not. It wasn't because I don't know if I'm going to quit forever, but I know I don't want to feel the way I feel there.
Yes. That, you know, that, you know, I think that's it. Is we come in with not with the intention of quitting, but with the intention of just trying to feel better.
Right. I can't live like this anymore. So even if it's not as bad as this, if I can get to the point where I can just do it on Fridays and Saturdays again, the understanding of... it's progressive was not a concept for me.
Right, right. So you go to this rehab. What's your experience like there?
Okay, I'm a good student.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
And I'm a good alcoholic and addict, so I can be whoever you want me to
be.
Right,
good actor. A good go-along.
Right. And they're, you know, they're loading me up with carbs, and they're teaching me classes, and I don't have to do laundry, and... they tell me when to wake up. They feed me. It's an easy life for a moment. You know, I got no troubles. There's no outside world to call to do anything. I'm just in my little bubble.
Does something strike you? Does something strike a nerve in there with you with this thing that you're going through, where they say something that makes sense to you?
My first dilemma was the counselor they gave me because I didn't identify. I compared. Originally, the counselor they gave me was younger than me and had never done drugs. He's a college kid with a degree. So immediately I discount
him. Purely academic.
Right. Yeah. I discount him altogether and say, like, dude, you probably have never even had kids. So, you know, but there's other people there. And what saved me was they brought meetings in from outside.
Okay.
And there were speakers there. They had the AA meetings and the NA meetings.
No.
So I could listen to people that came in from the outside talk.
So that experience, strength, and hope meant more than anything from people who had experienced what you had.
Yes. These were people I could relate to because when they said something, I could look in their eyes and say, yeah, you felt that pain, and you understand that hopelessness that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, you know, they hooked me up with a guy outside after the rehab, and he took me to a few meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, since it's 2004, my drug addiction is a bigger part of my story than my alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the guys back then said, you should go to NA.
Sure. Uh-huh. Yep.
And I actually got, I don't want to say tossed out of a meeting, but I got almost barred from entering one because I was trying to explain to these guys that I'm not an alcoholic. I'm an addict. Alcohol is just one of the drugs I'm addicted to.
Yeah.
Because this is what I'm learning.
Yeah.
So I'm standing my ground and thinking, you know, and the guy says, then you don't belong here. And I'm kind of looking at him like, you know, you're sending me out to die. You understand, right? If you're not letting me in this meeting, I could go out and die today. You go to that meeting. So I did, and I remember the guy that came in during one of the nights talking, and he said that he goes to these meetings, and I went to one of those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately started identifying with these people.
Yeah. This is in NA. NA. Yep.
Yes, yep. NA. I walk down a street, and there's people out front of the meeting. You know, one guy's got no teeth.
Sure.
I'm looking at these guys like, I'm not like these people.
Not
my first thought is like, I'm not like that. But those two guys ended up being my friends now for the last 20 years.
Finally, you had something in common.
Yes, but they were there, and I go to the meeting, and for the next 10 years, I'm working that program. I'm identifying with people. I don't know the time is going by, but I know that I'm not using drugs. I'm not drinking.
So you weren't even drinking.
Oh, God. Well, you can't drink. Over there, it's...
complete sobriety.
Over there, it's everything.
I see.
I can be sober and not clean, but I can't be clean and not sober.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can be sober and used to be and still smoke pot. Yeah. I can't be clean and smoke pot. For me, I've done nothing that wasn't prescribed to me for almost 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't ask you for a painkiller at
sure.
night for extra, that kind of thing. Most of the people I hang out with in AA live the same lifestyle. It's nothing.
Right.
They just, whatever. They've naturally gone to that point where it's like you're not asking your friend for a Valium one day because you're stressed. You realize that that could lead
That's
you...
That's a problem.
Yes. Yeah.
So you get clean, you work the steps, you get a sponsor in NA.
Yes.
How do you make your way back over to AA?
I never really left AA, but I focused on NA because I needed... That's where my help was.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my identification was. But I always had... I'd always go to a meeting or two every once in a while at the place I started because I knew people. And then eventually the problem, at least in this town, is that NA is probably 10% the size of AA.
Right.
So
sure.
All the people I come in with now have lives and we're busy. So there's no real social structure for me there's no fellowship.
Right.
And I meet a girl and she just happens to be in this program.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden for the next 9 years, we're going to this program. So I meet all these other people.
But you're getting the same.
Oh, the steps are the
yep.
same.
Yeah.
The NA took the steps and the traditions from AA.
Right.
They just changed a couple of words. Instead of alcohol, it's addiction. So they just broadened it for addicts because addicts eat anything. They're garbage heads. Alcoholics, for some people, they've never touched anything but alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Other people are garbage heads too. But the step work is the same. The traditions are the same. Sponsorship is the same. So everything I learned there...
was applicable.
Oh, it's the same thing as here. When I talk about a step at a meeting, I've worked that step.
Right.
I understand that step. I apply it in my life. So when I speak about it at an AA meeting, it's valid because it's the same step.
Of course.
And it's
just
for the
a
same,
different symptom.
Right. It's the same problem. It's an addiction that you have that we call alcoholism because it's a certain substance, and that's okay. But most people, once they've been here a while, don't worry about the alcohol. They worry about the ism.
Mm-hmm.
NA is the ism, more or less, from the beginning because you can't pick and choose which ones you have to stop. You have to stop everything.
I see.
Unless it's prescribed by a doctor and you take it the way it's prescribed.
Yeah.
That's the only legal way to do these things. So now I'm in AA, and I've known people for 10 years still that have gone to AA meetings. That wasn't my main program. And now I'm with a girl that's got, what's she got now, almost 30 years? I don't know. You know, she's got some time. So we're hanging out with a lot of couples that have time.
Nice.
And now I have the social structure, the fellowship that
right.
I need.
Life's coming back.
Yes. And I'm meeting a lot of people that understand recovery the way I understand recovery. And it's the same recovery.
Yeah,
it's just
the same, right.
It's just a different, you call it a different name
now,
if you want.
Now, you've had a foot in both realms, NA and AA, and can you talk a little bit about your step two and three, your spiritual part of your program and how that came about?
Yeah, I think all my steps are, I've had the same sponsor now for almost 17 years.
Wow.
So I've never worked AA steps. I imagine they're the same, but like my step work, it took me 7 years to go through 12 steps
mm-hmm.
because my sponsor, it wasn't like I didn't wake up one morning and say, I got the second step. It was like, no, you got to write and we got to talk about it and we're going to work through it. And then we're going to watch how you live a little bit. So the evidence started presenting itself in the second step was that like, okay, I'll use cleaner. So I'm sober for a little while now and maybe I can stay sober. That's part of the coming to believe hey, maybe this will work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not like it works for everybody else, but it's impossible for me. So why should I even try?
Yeah, that's starting to shift.
Yes, that shift is starting to happen. And also the shift is starting to happen that like, hey, you know what? If I show up to work every day, I don't get in trouble. Or if I pay my bills every month, they don't show up four times a month.
Huh.
They show up every 30 days like they're supposed to. And then I can pay them. And this evidence is bringing me back to some sanity that like I'm seeing this. And that's how the second step is starting to work for me, is that I'm building this evidence that I can be restored to a person that can live a reasonable life
mm-hmm.
because I'm starting to live a reasonable life. I need somebody to take my hands and walk me or to put blinders on me for a little while so that I don't stray. But now in my life, I've turned into a free-ranging person in long-term recovery. I need help, but I tend to recognize when I need help, or other people tend to recognize when I need help.
Yeah, right.
But I have those people in my life. I've set up an environment where more people are going to help me stay in this environment than take me away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the friends anymore that say, I dare you to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I have the friends that say, you know, you might want to ask a couple people before you make that choice. This doesn't look like a good idea for you. And then the third step was one of the harder ones. My sponsor kept me on that for a year, writing on it, because I would not let my daughter live her own life because she had a drug problem. So I kept playing her God. And I keep saying, you know, I'm ready to move. He's like, no, you're not, because you don't understand the basic concept of this, is that everybody has their own higher power and you're not it. So he's not like really holding me back, but he's teaching me that every time I come to him and start telling him about all these problems, he looks at me and says, is that stuff you're doing or somebody else?
Yeah.
And I'd say, my daughter or my son or somebody. He goes, then that's not your that's
so
not
you
your
need
behavior.
To let go and let God.
Yes, I need to learn that. And he's teaching me how to do that by making me write on this step all the time. Every time I start putting my hand in there and start controlling things, he's like, you know, you're really not ready to move on here. You got a good grasp of what's going on, but let's look at it again.
Right, like let's apply it to your life in reality and see where you are.
Right.
And so until you were able to do that,
yes,
he would not let you move on.
Right.
And that's the way you needed to learn, right?
For me, yes.
Yes.
Some people need to, I'm not against you plowing through the steps in a year and then going back to revisit them and do them my version the right way later, but... Well, if you walk 20 years into the woods, it's going to take you 20 years to get out. I'm not cured after 30 years of this lifestyle.
Yeah.
There's no way 30 weeks is going to fix me.
Right.
Or we wouldn't need the program.
Yeah.
You know, or the doctors would work. So I've been through the steps. I've now learned how to apply them in my life. I'm still working on steps.
You've helped others work on steps.
Yes, I've taken other people through steps. I journal to work on my steps. In NA, they have a workbook where you can answer questions. AA, I'm not sure how you do it, but I journal on whatever step I'm working on. Those are the things I'm picking out of my life that day. Like, where am I trying to take control? I finished my third step. I'm waiting for my sponsor to go over it again. And this is what I'll do forever.
Sure.
Because
if you're lucky.
Yes.
One day at a time.
Because the steps, I get more. The stuff I'm trying to fix now is stuff that I want to hold on to even with recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because I still got the recovery, and then I still want to hold on to some of those are behaviors that worked for me forever.
Yeah.
Why would I give them up now?
Yeah, I mean, it is a life's work. It really is. And you really have to become a student of yourself and your behavior and your thinking. And you got to keep an eye on it, and you got to bring up topics and bounce it off other people that are in recovery to really get the help, to get the answers you need.
Yes.
And even then, it's just a lot of work, man.
The day I stop doing step work or the day I stop going to meetings is the day I start relapsing.
Yeah, that's
right. This I've learned by watching people. You can graduate from a rehab program, but you can't graduate from
your
a 12-step program.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
There's no graduates.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, awesome. We go for life.
Yep, yep.
And that's the way I feel about it. And so far, it's working for me. I make a better class. My friends are healthy, which means I'm probably healthy because they're my friends still. People that are not quite healthy kind of fall off. Mm-hmm. And I always try to talk to people that know a little more than me. Or been around a little longer than me so that I can learn something. I'm trying to be teachable still.
Gotta be, yep.
You know, that's where I'm at with this, and it seems to be okay. I've been through so much, and my first wife, Patty, passed away. It'll be 10 years, the 14th of this month, overdose. Mm. My daughter passed away 5 years ago next month.
Jesus,
This
it doesn't stop.
No, life
it really
keeps going.
Doesn't. Yeah, it does.
And you're able to work through now. For the most part.
Yes. I don't see the point where drinking, going and getting drunk is going to matter, going to help that in any way.
Right.
Doesn't mean I haven't thought about it, but the idea that, oh, this is what I should do now because that happened is not really
it's
a
not
big
an
thought.
Option. Not
I,
an option.
I believe that I'm going to relapse more in a casual way where somebody accidentally hands me something and I take it because
that's
I forgot
real.
Who I am
yeah.
instead of me deciding that I'm going to go ruin my life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I have to be vigilant both ways. I can't just be at a party and grab a drink or something without knowing what it is.
All right. Well, we appreciate your story and your time and your experience, strength, and hope, Ed. We'd love to have you.
I just have one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Brett.
One thing that I've noticed, you know, another person in my life that's been very influential since I've been in here, and you have a Facebook page.
Yes.
So why don't you share that with everybody real quick?
Oh, yeah.
It's called Wisdom Wheel, where we just post inspirational quotes or anything like that, something that's uplifting or anything. If you want to be recovery related, it's fine. But mainly it's more like daily wisdom or informational or inspirational kind of quotes.
Yeah, and it's much different from the other stuff that's pushed to us throughout the day. And the reason I wanted, to bring it up because those little bits of wisdom, you know, we've got those in AA through the slogans and the sayings. But those are those little things, and I've consumed on that page as well, that get me through some of those times, right? Mm-hmm. So
it's a Facebook page, and the name of it is?
Wisdom Wheel.
Yeah. Wisdom Wheel.
Go
ahead and look
it
up. Check it out. Join, right? You can join the page.
Yep.
It's open.
Awesome. Well, that's great. All right. Well, until next time, I'm Mark.
I'm Brett.
I'm Ed.
As we wrap up another episode of the Glumlot Podcast, we want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in today. Navigating the path to recovery from alcohol and other substances is a journey filled with challenges, triumphs, and self-discovery. Remember, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here to provide a safe space for open conversations about the complexities of recovery. Your stories, courage, and resilience inspire us and our listeners alike. If you or someone you know is on the transformative journey, know that you're not alone. Join us next time as we continue to explore the diverse facets of recovery. Until then, stay strong, stay connected, and remember that each day is a step towards a brighter, sober tomorrow. Thank you for being part of the Glumlot community.